You are listening to I Am Interchange.
I am Interchange.
I am Interchange.
I am Interchange.
Fostering curiosity, education, and empathy by exploring the controversial and the provocative.
I am Interchange.
Welcome to the I Am Interchange Exchange podcast series, in which an evolving group of artists, activists, and entrepreneurs come together to examine controversial topics from varied perspectives in efforts toward provoking thoughtful and insightful dialogue. Today's topic, compassion versus practicality. How does compassion drive individual beliefs and shape personal and collective action? What are the polarities of social stewardship? And where do we draw the line between the head and the heart? We'll break our conversation into two issue-focused chapters, healthcare and immigration, to delve into the convergence of personal experience, political leanings, beliefs, and behavior. We grew up on the golden rule: treat others as we'd like to be treated. Generally, we interpreted this to mean treating those around us with respect, kindness, and a welcoming attitude so that we might accept those same courtesies. But that's often easier said than done. Over the course of our lifetimes, we encounter social conditioning, subliminal and overt messaging, and defining experiences that shape our beliefs about certain groups of people or social issues. They develop foundational thought patterns and perspectives that aren't so easily changed. Over the past decade, our nation's political landscape has become increasingly polarized, with each side finding increasing comfort in standing its ground rather than finding a common one. In addition, greater pressure on natural and financial resources in light of our political strife, violence, and the climate crisis is accelerating global refugeeism. In this episode, we'll take an honest look at how the divide between the head and the heart influences perspective on major social issues and policy development. We'll explore compassionate versus practical approaches to two key issues of the national debate: healthcare and immigration. And perhaps most importantly, we'll talk honestly about where the lines get blurry and how the gray area provides opportunity to have conversations about divisive issues based on mutual respect and understanding.
What do you think the world would look like if we didn't have borders?
Ooh, I think it would be phenomenal. Actually, yeah. So I spent a lot of time living and working all over the world, and I think my observation is that every culture has good and bad things, and if you did more intermingling of them, I feel like more of the good would rise to the top and more of the bad would get suppressed. And people would just understand each other's point of view, which is, I think, is the main, like, when the gears grind, it's because people have never had a meal together or lived in each other's culture to understand it.
What do you think the world would look like if we didn't have borders?
Elections would be really ugly, terrible. I think it might be more tense in some ways because our geography kind of allows people to go to their comfortable corners a little bit. And if we didn't have borders, that might not happen as much. And so we'd have a lot of tension, I think. But it's not, it wouldn't be all negative. I mean, I think there are a lot of positives.
What do you think the world would look like if we didn't have borders?
I don't think that's possible.
For the world to be without borders?
Yeah.
Well, hypothetically, if it could, yeah.
If you could, what would it be like? Oh, I think it would be anarchy. It would be Armageddon. No, I think ever since, you look at the Indians who had sustainable communities for 10,000 years, they had very strict borders. Pretty much any sustainable society had borders. So I don't think it would be sustainable.
So you think it's a beneficial thing to keep borders?
Oh, I think it's mandatory. I mean, much as I would like to accommodate everybody that wants to be here.
Where does compassion run out in your life?
Greedy people, closed-minded people.
We've got a great panel for this episode. Join me first in welcoming Foursquare Ministries pastor Jacob Schreiner, who believes compassion is fundamentally about honoring and valuing other people, regardless of their flaws, while holding them accountable for their behavior.
What if we had solutions that could send people home to better their communities and help the family they left behind?
Next up is Greg Smith, a pastor at St. James Episcopal. Greg's work as a priest and licensed therapist is guided by a belief that compassion is an expression of limitless love without parameters or boundaries.
I think we can't really avoid the conversation about what pain and suffering mean and whether or not we have compassion for people, because if I can help alleviate pain, I think that's necessary.
Similarly, Rabbi Ed Staffman believes that we are all intrinsically connected, but clarifies limits to our compassion when our life or health is at stake.
It seems to me that we ought to have an orderly way of doing this that balances compassion and our care for other humans, and at the same time doesn't so disrupt our culture to throw us into chaos.
An obstetrician gynecologist with years of experience, Dr. Claire Putnam recently opened up her clinic here in Montana. Claire's approach to compassion is to do what she can to help others while maintaining healthy boundaries to protect her own energy and well-being.
I think we do have to set limits for what this free healthcare can provide. And we also have to have some accountability as individuals in this society to say you're going to do X, Y, and Z to help take care of yourself.
Finally, Paul Nachman rounds out the panel. Paul founded Montanans for Immigration Law Enforcement and doesn't see himself as a particularly compassionate individual, aside from his desire to see the nation continue moving in a direction that supports a decent life for its citizens.
Do you agree that families should be held together at the border?
Oh, I'm fine with that, but the incentive should be changed so they stop coming to the border.
So they should just get killed. They should just die.
The United States is not responsible for everything that happens in
the
world.
So it's okay if they die, if they're killed.
What if there's another option?
I don't consider it our responsibility to protect people in Mexico from Mexico's government.
We'll kick off this episode with an open-ended question about our first topic. Universal healthcare. With 1 in 4 Americans foregoing medical treatment because of cost, what is to be said about the practicality of preventative treatment to avoid costs related to acute care? Claire will start us off with the breakdown of the statistical realities she has experienced as a physician. Jacob and Greg will then offer their experiences in paying for medical bills with alternative insurance approaches, and in working with less fortunate populations who suffer the consequences of expensive healthcare.
You know, there's no doubt that giving people preventative care costs less and is better for their health. I mean, if you put in vaccinations to people, do screening checks to catch diseases early, and intervene in earlier stages of disease, it will ultimately cost individuals as well as society less money. And so I feel very strongly that our shift in focus in healthcare when we decide to bring this back up and chew it is to actually take away from end-stage diseases and high technology and move back towards preventative care and wellness and prevention, basically.
Mm-hmm. End-stage diseases being kind of
cancers, advanced cancers, mm-hmm. stage 3, stage 4 cancers, advanced surgeries, joint replacements.
So putting those resources into preventative care diabetes. In advance?
Absolutely.
We don't pay for preventative. That's the one part about it that is unique to us. And the reason we don't pay for preventative is that in the first 5 to 10 years of the formation of the group and what they were working through, their single greatest cost was preventative care, above and beyond everything else that we were looking at in our shares, and the shares skyrocketed. So they made a decision to give every family, in essence, the choice on how they were going to handle their own preventative care, but that would then be handled out of our pockets. What it did is it cut our shares and the amount that we had to pay monthly significantly down, and then every family was able to take the money we were spending on shares and choose how we would spend that on preventative care. My share right now for a family of 6 people is just under $500 a month in what we share and what we send to other people. And for the 6 of us, I was spending over $1,800 a month in having full coverage on my family.
Pap smears are relatively cheap. It costs about $120 on the market for me to run a pap smear. It takes me 5 minutes to do a pap smear for a patient. Someone comes in for that cost, you know, they have to pay $75 to see me, I do a quick pap, I run that. If I catch cancer cell, pre-cancer cells, and do that and catch it in that early phase, it's just a matter of me taking a little magic wand and cutting that little part of the cervix off. It won't become cancer and they're cured. If that person doesn't go to the doctor and doesn't go get a pap smear, there's no way to know if she has those changes going on in that cervix. And when you come and have those bleeding symptoms from cervical cancer, that's fatal. That person is then shoved into the medical system with advanced surgery, chemotherapies, and their life is shortened. They have about 5 to 7 years to live with a typical cancer diagnosis.
I just want to talk about HIV prevention as being something vital here. Back in the day, we had no medication that would prevent HIV or prevent anyone from contracting HIV. Now we do. Just for a little bit of perspective, my medication costs about $11,000 a month if I were out of pocket paying, okay?
11.
The lifetime medical treatment is over $1 million per HIV, for AIDS patients, people in the last stages of life before the medications came around and before the cocktails were invented and the preventative stuff was involved. We're talking about hospitals and communities footing the bill for millions of dollars per patient. And I mean, diabetes is another perfect example. I think if we can do some prevention for type 2 diabetes, we're saving a lot of people's lives. You know, this is, it just makes mathematical sense to me. The United States pays the highest in the developing world and the developed world for medication. Is that true? Mostly, it's kind of high.
Yes, no, we.
And, but it's because we can. It's not because, I mean, insurance companies negotiate with pharmacies and all that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And the medications that cost a dollar, like I always got mad when Bono was putting up this pill and going, for a dollar a day, you can save a life. And I'm like, well.
In Africa.
But not here. Mm-hmm. Not here.
It's not necessarily.
So, I mean, we're basically paying for the rest of the world to have cheaper medication.
Taking the conversation to a more personal focus, is it just a medical system or regulatory government that allows people in the United States to be bankrupted by medical costs? Who should bear the weight of these costs, and are there better ways? We'll start with Paul, who sees the issue as less about healthcare costs and more about the ability to find work to pay for them.
I think the problem is overblown. From what I've read, I have no, you know, applicable experience, but I've read many articles saying that it's not medical costs that are bankrupting people. It's the fact that they can't work, and therefore, it's not the medical costs themselves. It's the inability to earn a living because they got these medical problems. So it's not the bills that are the problem. Is that conflict with what you're saying?
No, it's in conjunction. I mean, I think.
What about the little girl with $1 million bill?
Well, what about it?
Dealing with cancer.
Should
her family go bankrupt?
Not if they participate in an insurance program. What Jacob's talking about sounds to me like major medical, equivalent to major medical, which is what I think insurance should be. It should be for basically catastrophic stuff, not for, you know, the equivalent of oil changes and changing.
Isn't that preventative care?
No, that shouldn't be part of insurance. You just pay for that, you know, out of your ordinary living expenses. Yeah, that's sort of like in the 50s and the 60s. You go to the doctor for a minor thing, you get a bill in the mail, you pay it. You know, it's not all cycled through insurance.
When people get very sick and they have catastrophic chronic illnesses, a lot of chronic illness people, they end up losing their jobs. They can't keep them. And they lose often their health insurance attached to their jobs. And they go bankrupt. And they can't work and they can't support themselves and their families. It's a dire, I mean, I think if we work a little bit on preventing some of those chronic illnesses, stepping back a few steps, we would have a better workforce and we would have more people being able to pay for their families and medical bills.
It costs more to do the to test everybody and find the few than it does to, you know, have the few get sick and treat them.
The discussion about good use of medical spending leads to our next question for the panel. What's deemed medically necessary? We'll explore perspectives on medical avenues that could potentially be abused if universal healthcare came into play, and examine the role personal accountability plays in the issue.
So these are decisions, I think, that have to be made by a patient and a doctor in conjunction. And we awfully presumptuous of us to say what's medically necessary and what's not in most cases. Cosmetic surgery is clearly not in, if you're doing it solely for the purpose of becoming more beautiful, something that is medically necessary. But if you've been in a car accident and your face is half burned and you need to get cosmetic surgery so that you look normal, so to speak, that would be a case that's medically necessary. You know, this every system is got some amount of abuse, and it's just the price you pay for living in a society. We try to minimize it the best we can, but mostly, if we leave these decisions to the experts, we're going to get the best results, I think. Mm.
It's a very gray line about what's medically necessary. I often have patients. I have several patients who I say it's, you know, you have cancer. I diagnosed them with certain cancers, for instance, uterine cancer, and I've had several who said, the Lord will treat me. And I say, well, if we just can medically remove your uterus, you will be cured. Just a simple hysterectomy, no drugs, nothing beyond that. And they say, no, I don't want that. So is it medically necessary that she be treated for her cancer? Is it medically necessary that someone be dragged into the medical system when they don't want to? People right now are being medically vaccinated. Some of the Hasidic Jews, I believe, in Brooklyn or outside of there are being medically dragged into the system and forcefully immunized against measles, mumps, and rubella because of the recent outbreak there. And so the state has stepped in and said, this is medically necessary for you. And I don't necessarily agree with that, but and that's where I come from the platform of, I don't think anything really is necessarily medically necessary. Death will come to us all.
You want to talk about something that's medically necessary, I think we can't really avoid the conversation about what pain and suffering mean, and whether or not we have compassion for people in pain and suffering, or if we don't care, we're just looking for our own selves, and they can, you know, whatever. They don't have anything to do with me. But to go back to what Ed said in the beginning of, like, the connection between creation and other human beings, to me, that's the thing that just brings it all into focus. Because if I can help alleviate pain, I think that's necessary, personally. And if I can alleviate someone's suffering, I think that's necessary, if they want to be relieved of it. When I make a recommendation for my patients, maybe transgender patients, for surgery, and they say no, I have to go in there and make a case for the physical and emotional and mental suffering that's going on inside this person that can be corrected, often a great deal corrected by simple surgeries, simple procedures. Same thing is true with medications. If a doctor and I talk about a mutual patient who needs a medication, insurance companies can refuse to cover certain medications, but if they really need it, we have to go in there and fight like hell for it sometimes. And I just think we've become so inured to other people's suffering that it just becomes too hard and we give up.
Is it society's role to spend their money on someone who won't take care of themselves?
No.
Why not?
Because resources are finite. Human wants are infinite. This is where practicality comes in.
It's not generosity if I take out of your pocket and I pay someone else's bills. It's generosity when I choose out of my own pocket to take care of someone. It's compassion when I step in and add the human element. When you put a system like universal healthcare in place, and I have family in Europe, I have and missionaries that are friends all over the world that have functioned in all kinds of different systems, it never functions at the level we hope it will when we make something available across the board without accountability. And when we just say, well, we'll just give it to people, it breeds a level of life that takes people away from, I would say, responsibility for our own choices, responsibility for our own actions. And we can't just say, well, I'm just going to pull it from the whole, because that's not generous. That's not compassion.
It's not that simple. Nobody's taking anything out of the pocket. I mean, we're paying for it. We're paying tax dollars for it. Things like universal health care, You know, it's never going to be perfect. But I also believe in the ingenuity of human beings to solve problems and to get together and not ignore problems and shut things down or deny, but to come together and find a way to solve them. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the great things about the United States of America, is that we, you know, we set a goal, or used to, and then we would cover it. We would take care of it. Mm-hmm. Man on the moon, done. We can do this. This is not that hard.
But that's the whole point. They chose to put a man on the moon.
Now, it is frustrating when there are people who smoke cigarettes, knowing that they're increasing their likelihood of lung cancer, which is going to cost us all money in the end. But the truth is that most of us have vices of one kind or another. That has no sin cast the first stone. Many of us are carrying around too much weight that makes us vulnerable to diabetes and other diseases. In all these other countries, it works. And there's different systems, right? Australia has a little different system than England. It has a different system. I don't know what Norway's system is. But it works. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. This is easy. This is an easy solution. The fact is, we have universal health care already. It just happens in emergency rooms. The most expensive way to do it. This is a very easily solvable problem. And this idea that somehow you're going to be taken advantage of, this is paranoia, that they're going to take advantage of me, they're going to take advantage of me. That's not compassionate. That's paranoid.
I think we do have to set limits for what this free healthcare can provide. And we also have to have some accountability as individuals in this society to say, you're going to do X, Y, and Z to help take care of yourself. That doesn't necessarily mean everybody has to stop smoking or lose 50 pounds, but people have to take their medications correctly and participate in ways to help improve their health. In these systems. And I think, yes, I do think the society should step in and say there's this basic level of care for everyone, and then people can buy their, if they want more, they can buy more and access more and fancier things.
Is compassion unconditional? That's what I really want to know. Is unconditional like practical, though?
There is the practicality that if somebody has committed a murder, and we believe is likely to commit another, compassion, it's... It might be compassionate to say, don't worry about it, just live down the street. But I think we have to protect ourselves, and that's why we have a prison, and we're going to lock that guy up so he doesn't kill somebody else. So you could say that's the limit of compassion, that we've got to take care of ourselves. But that's a very high standard. You know, in other words, it's not just some unfounded fear. If the person, it's a clear and present danger that this person's going to cause to us, that's where compassion ends.
Even with the murderer, even with somebody who's done something heinous and horrible, if I can still hold them as a human being and not negate their humanity, which is what we do in our prison systems, I wouldn't have any problem with that. I don't have a problem with that. I think we have rules in place to keep ourselves and others safe, and when those rules are violated, something has to happen. But I don't think we dehumanize the other and turn them into monsters. Mm-hmm. We do that. We just do that so quickly these days. And it's inhuman.
I just don't think in terms of compassion.
I think you're compassionate in some ways.
Why put at risk a system that's been very good? How many people should the United States have before you'd be uncomfortable?
At this point, our conversation turns to how compassion and practicality influence the immigration debate. While the healthcare conversation was driven by personal experience that allowed panelists to find common ground on several points, the immigration issue became an immediately passionate debate around the legitimacy claims for asylum and the number of people that should be allowed into the United States.
Well, an asylum seeker is someone who is already here, who claims that they'd be in danger, and they can be here legally or illegally. And for instance, the Chinese students who were here at the time of the Tiananmen Square upset in China, people who were already here as students, well, they were granted asylum or if they wanted it because it was dangerous to go back to China. So they were here legally. On the other hand, they could be here illegally and ask for asylum and sometimes get it. An immigrant more generally, Ed talked about 20,000 refugees in 2016.
Asylum seekers, people who got asylum.
Specifically refugees. Asylum seeker is another category, really.
What was the level overall level of legal immigration in 2016?
I don't know. I'm something of an expert in asylum, but not overall immigration or other kinds.
Want to take a guess?
I don't know.
A million.
So that means asylum seekers are just a tiny part of it.
We're talking about, yeah, okay, but I'm talking about immigration.
I doubt, that's hard to believe.
Yeah.
Well, I'd like to see that data.
That's a basic fact. It's not exactly a million. I'm talking about round numbers. And so we're mostly talking about what you call green card holders. And some of those people, like 150,000 a year, are admitted because of their usefulness to the economy. And the other, about 800,000, are family members of people who are already here. That's what we call chain migration or chain immigration. So, in fact, most of the immigrants we get nowadays are chosen by other immigrants, not by the American polity. I lived in Redondo Beach, and that's what sensitized me to what was going on.
When was this?
1996 to 2005.
Okay.
Yeah, it was all around me, and was the billboards in Spanish, the day laborers at the nearby gas station, the constant controversy over it, just the crowdedness of Southern California. The impact on the schools, something like 100 languages, foreign languages spoken in LA Unified School District. Just the impacts on the existing American society.
I think we all agreed on this. Do you agree that families should be held together at the border?
Oh, I'm fine with that, but the incentives should be changed so they stop coming to the border.
So they should just get killed. They should just die.
The United States is not responsible.
No, answer my question. They should die is your solution.
The United States is not responsible for everything that happens in
so
the world.
So it's okay if they die, if they're killed.
What if there's another option?
I don't consider it our responsibility to protect people in Mexico from Mexico's government.
How much money are we spending holding them and detaining them right now? Does anyone know?
It's
millions. What if instead we began to put that money into working with the Mexican government, working with and World Health Organizations, working with people who can begin then to use those resources? What if we had solutions that could send people home to better their communities and help the family they left behind?
That would be great, but for right now, they're gonna get killed.
I would also just submit that the United States has monkeyed around with every country south of our border and created a lot of these problems. We are responsible in a lot of ways for them fleeing these dictatorships that we've propped up and we've, kind of messed with.
There's also a very practical consideration for how immigrants currently support our economy and how imposing more stringent limits would impact industries like agriculture that have long relied on migrant labor.
I do see the needs of having people come in and do jobs that we as Americans don't, frankly, want to do. And a lot of that is hard work, farm work, ranch work, agricultural work, nanning, house nannies, service providers, house cleaning. These are things that we as Americans somehow seem to feel like we're above that.
In addressing immigration, we uncover a distinct polarity, with some people believing that advocated sentiments dangerously approach hate-based speech and activity. In this next segment, we'll momentarily veer away from the immigration issue to explore where compassion comes into play in supporting free speech, or alternatively, making the decision to censor a reasonable approach. We'll begin by addressing an article Paul wrote that was highly critical of the Southern Poverty Law Center, the SPLC, and created controversy here around Bozeman. During this exchange, Rabbi Ed references a list of hate groups compiled by the SPLC on their website at www.splccenter.org. One of the groups listed in the anti-immigrant category is the Center for Immigration Studies, an organization whose research and writing is cited by Paul Nachman as a backup for his arguments. Listeners are invited to research both sources to get the full picture of each group's perspective.
I need to raise another issue that hasn't been raised here that's related to this,
please,
if I can. And that is, we're talking about this as if it's just a pure policy question. And some of it is, but I testified on a bill in the legislature that had to do with immigration. And the people on the other side who were opposing me were a group called FAIR, which is a designated hate group, a racist, Nazi-like loving a white supremacist group.
This is bullshit.
The Montana Family Foundation just got marked.
You don't see the same kind of fight against immigration for the Chinese, who are the largest group coming, that you do for brown people and black people. As our president said, you know, he bring over the Norwegians, just not from the shithole countries. Right? Mm-hmm. That's what's going on underneath this whole thing. And don't you believe anything else.
This is part of what I wanted to get into. Our initial event partners read an article that you wrote that criticized the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Uh-huh.
We don't have to get into, I don't want to get into details of the article. I just want to talk about when, is it compassionate to silence someone's perspective? So our partners we decided to part ways on the event because we didn't want to take away a polarity. This event is about exploring polarities. And you were the polarity for the event, or one of the polarities. We agreed to part ways because we didn't want to silence it. Anyway, they were critical of your critical article on the Southern Poverty Law Center. Mm-hmm. When should someone be cut off from sharing their perspective? Paul, do you promote hate?
No.
How, I mean...
Promote hate? What's the point?
Well, the Southern Poverty Law Center pinpoints hate groups.
Well, they...
Is there a gray area in that? How do you feel about that?
They name anyone they disagree with as a hate group.
There are 30 pages of documentation on their site, just the group fare, that, maybe not quite 30, 25, I think, just the group fare of why they've labeled them a hate group. Now, you can like the Southern Poverty Law Center or not like them. That's up to you. But you read their underlying evidence. Statements that Mr. Taunton has made over the years that are footnoted and documented carefully. And there can be no other conclusion, but this is a racist, white supremacist group.
Jacob and Greg, will you talk a little bit about the Montana Family Foundation?
Mostly, I'm angry at the Montana Family Foundation because I have children whom I know living in Christian homes who come out as either gay or transgender, and they are told that you have to leave this house. You cannot be my child. Happens in Catholic homes, Jewish homes, I'm sure it happens everywhere. But the things that we've been adamantly at loggerheads about have been the humanity of sexuality. And what is that? I remember being turned on by seeing men when I was 7. We were all in a treehouse and there was a Playboy magazine and I was kind of like, oh, well, she's got nice hair, I guess. But. And then there was another magazine that had a picture of,
hair.
Of,
hair.
Of men,
hair.
That men in, and I was like, wow, this is really exciting, like, this is cool. And then I was like, oh shit, this is bad, this is bad. And if you bring it into that place where it's choice, I can't go there. And I also believe, and I've worked with so many transgender kids over the course of my career, 20 years plus, that no one would ever choose that.
Mm-hmm.
No one would ever make up that experience in order to go through the worst harassment. The most maligned group of human beings in this country now are transgender human beings. And I think the Montana Family Foundation, by the attitude that they have, is compromising children's safety and my safety.
We lose religious freedom in the middle of things because you take away the church's ability at times to say, we don't agree with that scripturally, and stand against Christians who would say, I don't have a problem with people, I don't want to walk out of saying that a gay person can't do this or that. They're not trying to infringe on anyone's rights. They're simply saying, I don't agree, and I don't believe that having to be forced then to step into the middle of that. Human rights violations are across the board.
It doesn't hurt anybody.
We'll conclude this episode by returning to our original topic with panelists' reflection on what it would mean to open all of our borders to immigration. Panel responses further illuminate practical concerns about ballooning global refugeeism as climate change impacts people's ability to find the resources needed to survive, or how to fairly govern a society comprised of conflicting identities and cultural norms. The final comments from our panel realize the difficulty in developing and employing compassionate pragmatism and remind us that open dialogue is often the best way to unearth the personal fears and beliefs underlying our political positioning.
There are now an estimated 258 million people living in a country other than their own country of birth. An increase of 49% since 2000, according to new figures released by the UN. What will this look like with rising sea levels and climate refugees in 20 years, in 50 years? I really want to explore with you all now what it would be like if we just opened all the borders.
The U.S. will become part of the third world, as parts of it already are, but it'll be more and more so. And until people stop coming because the U.S. is no more attractive than the places they would be leaving behind.
Personally, I think there's enough of wanting to retain what we have in me to say we've got to find a reasonable balance, that open borders where anybody can go anywhere is just too disruptive. It may be not in the ideal world, maybe it shouldn't be. Maybe everybody here in the whole world should be treated as the same. But we are, we do have a culture with certain values. And at some level, if you disrupt that culture too much, you end up creating chaos that's not good for anybody. And so there should be, mm-hmm. It seems to me that we ought to have an orderly way of doing this that is both, that balances compassion and our care for one, for other humans, and at the same time doesn't so disrupt our culture to throw us into chaos.
I can't imagine us having a border, open borders. It's really hard for me to imagine, even with my eyes closed. And the concept of holding people out and measuring who's coming in and tracking things and just the way our economy works with illegal immigration and legal. I just can't imagine that whole free market. That would just the influx of people coming in and the outflux too. I just can't imagine it.
Borders are meant to kind of protect or, you know, ensure. But I kind of agree that an open border system would be pretty chaotic. What would it mean?
Who would vote?
Yeah.
Like, who would pay taxes?
The whole structure of society would have to be really radically evaluated and reevaluated. And we can't even do it in a small country somewhere. You know, can't get it right. And so opening it up to the world, I think, would be pretty crazy. But at the same time, I don't want anybody to be denied freedom because they're fleeing pain and suffering and death.
Borders and the choice for and having walls in a home, the things that we do, aren't about our hate for what's outside. Most of the time it's for what is protecting what we love. There's just a framework for what it is to protect, and I don't think, I think there has to be a better solution than just throwing it open. I don't think the solution, though, is just closing it all off either, because I believe everyone can add value.
So how do you think it went tonight?
This panel tonight was amazing. There was a time when I thought everything was really going to fall apart, and it didn't. And the fact that the speakers could get through this evening and stay clear was really, really amazing. Like, I'm going to go home with, you know, the hope that conversations can actually happen. And tonight was a really challenging. Both subjects were really challenging. So, thank you.
So, how do you think it went tonight?
I thought it was really interesting. I really appreciated seeing all the different people on the panel and getting lots of different perspectives. That's why I really love Interchange. Sometimes I come to this and I always think about what I think about the topic, and I'm always leaning on one direction, but then after Interchange, I'm always questioning what I think. I definitely agreed with Greg pretty much the whole time. I think I'm more on the side of compassion versus like practicality, and at the same time seeing, like, viewing what that would look like is really important.
I Am Interchange has aligned its projects with the United Nations and its 17 sustainable developmental goals to accomplish by 2030. This episode has aligned with Goal 1, no poverty. Goal 3, good health and well-being. Goal 4, quality education. Goal 5, gender equality. Goal 10, reduced inequalities. Goal 16, peace, justice, and strong institutions. And Goal 17, partnerships for the goals.
This episode was brought to you by the Montana Governor's Office of Economic Development, the City of Bozeman, 10 Directions, Hatch, the Yellowstone Theological Institute, Montucky Cold Snacks, the Nova Cafe, Zocalo Coffee House, Whistle Pig Korean, Dean Zesty Booch, Bliss, the Sola Cafe and Market, Schenck Construction, Ben Johnson Photography, Loken Productions, Superfluous Industries, and Blunderbuss.
A special thank you to Katie Kaminsky, Tia Goble, and Connor Mulvaney, Bozeman Documentary Series, and Last Best Comedy.
A shout out to our editors and media team, Pat Loken, Jessup Sandoval, Allison Gregory, Shannon Hughes, Jessica Byerly, Jacob Desch, Nathaniel Johns, and Nicholas Hill. A special thanks, as always, to Debbie Schenck, Joe Fedora, Ethan Hoare, and Elliot Canfield. Do you have an issue that's riddled by gridlock in your community? We want to hear from you. Shoot me a message at tate@iaminterchange.org. That's tate@iaminterchange.org. Until next time, share airtime and don't ruin dinner.